Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol and also to all of you on Preston FM listening on 103.2 and also on Radio Verulam in St Albans and also to our listeners in Swindon. Hello Swindon FM. We also have gained listeners on the Halifax Community Radio Station, that's Calderdale FM, and also to listeners in Huddersfield on Kirklees FM, because in a minute we're going to play a track by the Savannah Jazz Band and they're based up in the north of England near those two cities.
Either they pay the bribes, which is illegal, or they act on their own initiative, which is illegal too. So no matter what you do, you live in a country where you will always be a criminal, unless you're dead.
Yes, coming up in the programme, our reporter Anthea Page has a feature on the daily life in Syria at the moment, which is a break from the recent reports on Albania, but we'll be back with those next week. Tony Gosling brings us a report from Andrew Gilligan about the Leveson inquiry into newspaper hacking. And we also have Syria in the 18th century as Malcolm Grieve reads another instalment of Lady Stanhope's travels.
Yeah, I think the public always make their own mind up. You know, I'll either go into the house and they'll hate me from the beginning or they'll love me. It's going to be a love-hate relationship.
Yep, coming up on your screens later in this year will be Channel 5's Big Brother. We also have Jeff Sparks back in the studio with his What's On guide and poetry from new contributor Tony Dalpino.
So before we introduce our first guest, let's hear Creole Bells from the Savannah Jazz Band from up the north of England. The album is called It's a Beautiful Picture. So there we go, take it away.
Thank you.
I'd like to welcome our guest this week, Caroline Bowler.
Hello.
And you're the manager of Stanford's bookstore in Bristol.
Right.
So where is that for people who've not been there before?
Right. It's actually in the Old City. There's a new rough guide to Bristol, Bath and the West Country, just in case you don't know. And we are actually mentioned in there. And it's right off of Corn Street, right off the city centre. So 29 Corn Street between the centre and St Nicholas Market.
Great. How long have you been there?
Well, the shop, our shop, has been there for 17 years. No, sorry. Take it back, 15 this July.
Wow, that's quite a long time.
Yes, long time. But our flagship shop in London has been there for over 150 years.
That's incredible.
Yes.
So there's a lot of kind of rich history associated with the shop, I presume.
Yes, we've certainly had our ups and downs and changes, and we've been through all sorts of different kinds of periods of history and managed to survive somehow. Right now, another big change with the internet.
So how did the first flagship store come about? When did people start wanting travel books? When did it become a thing?
Well, it wasn't really about travel books then. It was about maps. Edward Stanford was a cartographer and did the first to scale map of London and saw maps and colonialism as a way of, you know, he took advantage of the situation and expanded his repertoire. Everyone needed maps. And then
the original travel book, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't really until the 70s, I would say, that it became mainstream. People started travelling as people had more disposable income and so on. I'd say the first travel book was actually done by Footprints, who are still in business, and they did a travel guide to South America, to Brazil, because of all the packets coming out of Falmouth, all the boats.
And when was that?
That was, I'd say, probably about 1920s.
So quite a while ago then.
Yeah. Yeah, quite a while ago. But that was because there was a demand. I suppose it's all been, I mean, really, if you think about it, Lonely Planet really started in the sort of 70s. And that's really when people started getting going and could do long-haul travel. And, you know, it was a real adventure then, wasn't it?
Yeah, this must be a big difference between, because obviously you've got your kind of expedition, far-flung places, and then your holidays, your sun, sea, sand. So how have travel books met those two different the market?
Ooh, I'd say there's more than two markets, but you're absolutely right. There's the real explorer that goes off. The BBC, for example, they come and use a lot of our maps when they're doing programmes and they're doing their research. Then there's the intrepid traveller who goes off and walks the Himalayas on his own or her own. Then there's students, they go off on their gap years. Then there are families who go off to Spain. Then there are Brits who love to walk from John O'Groats to Land's End. You know, lots of people walking and cycling all over Britain and camping. Then there's city breaks. So there's all kinds of profiles to our travellers. You know, there are people that actually travel as a way of life, and there are people who do it just for holidays and so on. So lots of different people there.
And I presume you've got individual books for all of those different types of audiences.
Yeah, we try to. Sometimes it's quite difficult to fulfill. People come in to the shop and assume that we have, for example, large-scale mapping of every country in the world because we're so used to it in Britain. We have such a good, you know, the Ordnance Survey is so excellent. And sometimes it is quite difficult to get some countries' overseas maps that are large-scale. In fact, they don't exist. You can't get hold of them. But that is probably what we're most well known for, is getting those obscure maps. And our staff have been known to go to a tiny little publishers in the middle of nowhere in India and get a whole sort of year's worth of maps, because that's the only way we can get them. And that's what our specialisation is.
Okay. In terms of the really far-flung places, so our executive producer, Anthea, has recently been to Albania, which isn't kind of high up on most people's visit list, but have you found in recent times, or maybe even been for decades, that people want to go to quite
Burma,
difficult, interesting places where they might potentially have quite a lot of upheaval and unrest?
Burma right now is you know, because that's undergone quite a big change in the last year, and suddenly people are wanting to go there. And yeah, it changes all the time.
Does it kind of tally with what's been in the news recently? Obviously, like you say, Aung San Suu Kyi's kind of got a seat and there's been an awful lot of kind of press and glamour. So do you find that it tallies?
Absolutely, yeah. It has a big knock-on effect. And it also draws attention to a country, you know, like Albania, which you've only recently been allowed to actually go there, and people are obviously curious, and in a way like Croatia, you know, and suddenly everyone started going to Croatia. It's so at the time, it was a few years ago now, but it was sort of like Greece 30 or 40 years ago. It was untouched, and you know, there's a lot to be gained from a country that hasn't been hit by tourism. You see it in its proper colours.
Yeah. Apart from Burma, where else is kind of hot right now? I don't want to say it like that, but...
Where else is hot right now? Well, America. Always America. Lots of people going to California. There's a big romantic British view of California and the Indian lands and the canyons and the desert and all of that, and driving out and having miles and miles of expanse. Beautiful, beautiful countryside, you know, it's wonderful. That's big. Actually, Britain right now, funnily enough, even though the weather's horrible, I think a lot of people are staying home.
So all France, of that marketing spends on those big adverts are working then?
Yeah, okay, absolutely. All the Visit England, I suppose it's the Olympics and the Jubilee and the London Olympiad, all the events going on down in Dorset, and you know, there's so many things happening. Although it's pretty dreary right now, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But let's not talk about.
No, let's not talk about that.
I'm saving the hardest questions we'll ask. Obviously, the internet, Amazon, TripAdvisor, all of these kind of free resources must be having an effect on your business. How have you been managing that, and what do you think about it?
Well, I think the internet, we have a website and we have a writer, and part of her job is to actually give quite in-depth profiles of various countries. And that's been something that's very much sort of going down the TripAdvisor route, but it's giving information about the countries, and then we advise on books and maps and so on. So that's one way we've been sort of trying to stay in the market. We have to inspire people, I think. You know, very often we're at the end of the travel process where people have already made up their mind where they're going to go. We have to actually be the ones who say, oh, you know, have you done this? Have you read this? Have you seen this? This is what we advise, blah, 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 blah. You know, I think our staff is very good at that. But it's hard. Yep, it's hard. Definitely hard.
Well, that was the difficult question.
Yeah.
Through it now. Do you have any events coming up that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, we do actually. We've got Monty Halls. It's part of the big Bristol's Big Green Fringe Festival. We're involved with that. He's going to be talking about his latest programme, which was Big Catch, which is basically about sadly about the demise of the small British fishing industry. But he's a great talker and he's very knowledgeable. He's a diver, and I would recommend people to come see him. He's at the QEH, 8th of June, 7:30.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining me today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
There have been some charges this week, the first in the Marathon phone hacking scandal. But 5 years ago, much of what we know today was being discussed by legendary BBC journalist Andrew Gilligan, here at Bristol's Arnold Feeney. Andrew Gilligan and the BBC Director General, Greg Dyke, were both sacked back in 2003 for reporting the sexing up of the Iraq dossier. Sacked for telling the truth? Anyway, here is Andrew Gilligan from 2007 giving his take on why the press is in such a mess.
But I haven't yet come to the most serious part of the attack on journalism, from within the media industry itself. What's happened over the last 20 years, broadly since Rupert Murdoch's move to Wapping, is that it's become possible to make money from newspapers. Because of the print unions, it never used to be. Newspapers weren't really proper businesses. People owned them not for profit, but for prestige or influence. Suddenly, almost overnight, with the print unions taken out of the equation, the newspapers became increasingly profitable, incredibly profitable, actually. They started to be treated like any other business. So owners were able to do the usual things, consolidations, mergers, squeezing costs, takeovers. And, of course, there were plenty of costs to be squeezed. There was a lot of waste. But a lot of the owners, I'm thinking, say, of Trinity Mirror, didn't know where to stop. They got greedy. Even though they were making very good profits from their newspapers, they wanted to make more and more. And by that time, they were cutting into the bone. and often with managers who seem to regard journalism as very little different from any other consumer product, like washing machines or cars. So over the last 20 years, we've seen a dramatic decline in the number of reporting journalists, but a dramatic increase in the amount of space they have to fill. They have to do far more stories with far less time on each story. Producing a car in less time might be a good idea. It's a standard product. It's easy to check whether or not it works. It probably does make it cheaper. But journalism, of course, is not a standard product. And producing journalism in less time risks fundamentally altering its nature. Because at the same time as the number of journalists has shrunk, the number of anti-journalists, if you like, has risen to fill the gap. If you were writing a story about a hospital, you used to be able to speak to the manager or the consultant. If you were writing about a crime, you used to be able to speak to the investigating officer in charge. Now, however, of course, you have to speak to the PR. And every organisation, private and public, has seen a massive increase in this army of anti-journalists. And increasingly, because we are so thin on the ground and so overstretched, they're not just managing contact with the media. They are shaping the content of the media. They are writing the newspapers. Because we, the hacks, often don't have time to do much more than process what they give us. And that might help explain why, to begin with, we did so badly over Iraq. Most journalists want two things. They want stories, and they want other people to follow up their stories. And the government PRs knew that. They provided juicy stories. There was a great one in the Sunday Telegraph, where I used to work, this is after I'd left, about the belly dancers of death. Anyone remember that one? This was that a secret operation, codenamed Operation Falcon, according to Western intelligence sources, was aiming to fan out highly trained Iraqi killer agents disguised as actresses and belly dancers into the streets of London to kill and maim dissidents. And, you know, this complete load of old drivel was swallowed wholesale by the Sunday Times because they knew, Sunday Telegraph, because they knew that it would be confirmed the following day by the Foreign Office as it duly was, and it would be followed up as it duly was by other newspapers. And that, for that particular journalist who wrote that story, became his definition of truth. The fact is, it just wasn't in his interest to do the routine journalistic checks that would have exposed that story as the nonsense it was, because it was a story, it was going to be confirmed. I was on the BBC at that by that point, and I was invited to follow it up by my editor. I rang the Home Office, actually, and asked how many visas have been granted for Iraqi belly dancers in the last 15 years, and they said none. How many visas have been granted for any kind of belly dancers, and they said one. So I don't think that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And increasingly, what we're finding is official sources are not just sources of news, they're also arbiters of news. Because if you do a story on your own, if you do the work, you do an investigation, you beaver away for weeks on your own, you come up with a great story. The fact is, it might be rather inconvenient to those in power. It will often be denied. It will not be followed up by your colleagues. And you need exceptional determination in a newspaper, more importantly, with exceptional determination to keep it going. The Guardian's expose of BAE's bribery was one such example. They had to keep plugging away at that, you know, pretty much every week for literally months before anyone else took it up, because it was denied and denied and denied. And only very, very few newspapers have the kind of determination shown by The Guardian on that story, a determination which eventually, but only eventually, paid off.
Andrew Gilligan there, who was sacked from the BBC for telling the truth about the WMD lies. I'm now joined by Mr. Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John.
So, how was phone hacking allowed?
Well, the fact is, we had a really corrupt thing going on between particularly the Murdoch Empire and Scotland Yard. Now, if you think about it, if you've got corruption in your policing service and in your media at the same time, the same people, I mean, there was a lot of ex-police working with the Murdoch Empire. There were lots of ex-journalists, Murdoch journalists, working in the press office at Scotland Yard, for example. If those people are corrupted, as it now is absolutely clear they were, then none of what the rest of the society is trying to do can function properly. Just think about it. I mean, you've got these big terrorist attacks in 2005, for example, on the London Underground. If you can't trust the police who are trying to investigate that, where are you going to go? Because there's nowhere else. Ultimately, it means that they're covering the backs of their fellow officers who are crooked and corrupt. We're now starting to get to the bottom of some of this. We've had the two top cops in Scotland Yard have resigned. There's also John Yates as well from the anti-terrorist branch, Andy Heyman. These people have now gone. So at least there's a chance that some of the honest police are going to get to the bottom of it. But if you've got a corrupt media and a corrupt centre of your policing system, you've got a real problem. And even the MPs won't be able to deal with it until the police have actually arrested the crooked cops.
I mean, how do you think we're going to be able to avoid this sort of problem coming into place in the future, apart from just regulating everything to kingdom come?
Well, I think, no, it doesn't need to be regulated. There just needs to be openness and accountability with the police. I mean, in a lot of corrupt third world countries, banana republics and this kind of thing, the police are very, very secretive and they're not transparent. One of the traditions we have here in Britain is that the police are accountable to government and they're accountable to the people and they are more transparent.
Is there a limit to that transparency, realistically?
Well, there has to be to a certain extent. But when you're thinking about the police, don't just think about the ordinary civil police. There's also the military police as well, which runs alongside that, as well as other types of police forces we don't hear that much about. For example,
the civil nuclear constabulary.
Well, there's them, and also the Ministry of Defence Police. Mm. Now, a lot of these other types of policing services, including what essentially what MI5, the Internal Security Service, do, is another form of policing. So it's really important that we have a bit more transparency and that the honest cops are allowed to do their job and arrest and charge police officers and journalists who've been corrupt. Because what we've seen in this whole business is, for example, private investigators getting access to the police national computer and even deleting evidence. So a detective would turn up for work on a Monday morning and find the evidence that they've been collecting to prosecute someone the previous week has been deleted and disappeared. This has to be stopped if you're going to have a country that can run
effectively. So is this basically saying that Gilligan, to hark back to the Gilligan involvement, and he was a fool guy, he got sacked basically for just saying what was actually true?
Absolutely right. And what's quite clear about the whole Iraq debacle is that there had already been a decision made at a much higher level than the government that there was going to be a war. And the BBC had literally been co-opted to help with that. Now, you might think, well, surely the BBC would never do that. But if you go back to the 1930s and the creation of the BBC, Lord Reith, who started it all, was a fascist. He wouldn't allow Winston Churchill to go on the airwaves at all up until he was sacked. And the reason I say he's a fascist is because after Reith had been sacked and been stopping Churchill and supporting Hitler, actually, in the 1930s, he also actually supported Hitler's invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1939. So Reith, who created the BBC, was really far right, as of course was Edward VIII, who finally abdicated.
Right, okay, so where can we go to get the truth?
Well, there's all sorts of places. I'm afraid it's difficult other than the internet to find places. I would suggest there's a very good website called globalresearch.ca, which is the Centre for Research on Globalisation, which gives you a really good overview. Plus, there's sites which are digests like whatreallyhappened.com. But ultimately, you know, you want to look at supporting one of the campaigns for press freedom in Britain, which is looking at better ways to regulate, soft touch regulate the press, and also make sure that corruption within the press and within the police is actually dealt with rather than just swept under the carpet, because we can't be in a situation where police can be so easily bribed to get information and then are covering for their colleagues who are corrupt.
Okay, well, we should come back to this at another point.
The other thing, of course, is you've got to get the book Dial M for Murdoch, which is by Tom Watson.
This really, is quite recently new out.
This is just out, and if you really want to get to the bottom of some of the depths to which Murdoch's empire was sinking, I mean, they were effectively running their own intelligence service in competition with the government.
I understand it's written by a Guardian journalist and Tom Watson. Who's Tom Watson, if people don't know who?
Tom Watson is a Labour MP who's been really at the forefront of making sure that this inquiry goes to its full stretch against, of course, the Jeremy Hunt, who's the Culture Secretary. It's just been exposed in the last couple of weeks that Jeremy Hunt was actually trying to stop the police inquiry to help Murdoch get his Beast Guy beat bid. And amazingly enough, Jeremy Hunt's still in his job as we speak, but he may not be by the time you hear this. Also, remember, our own media in this part of the world, HTV, was for many years chaired by a guy called Louis Sherwood, who was a very different character. And I remember having a chat with Louis about Murdoch. He said, "Don't mention Murdoch in my car. That man is poison."
But he's so smiling and congenial. How could you have a problem with him?
I don't know. He gives me the creeps, Murdoch, and I think the sooner he's out of the country or under arrest, the better.
Well, on that note, on that bombshell, Tony Gosling, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Our next feature was recorded in Albania, but it's about daily life in Syria from a Danish lady who has friends over in Damascus. For security reasons, we have withheld her name.
I'm sitting in a fantastic Ottoman house in Berat, and I've met a Danish lady who's travelled to Syria. Hello. Can you tell us about the political situation in Syria, which I believe you know quite well?
The situation is such that you've got the two big cities, Damascus and Aleppo, who are still on the side of the regime. And then you've got smaller towns and townships and cities, like Homs, for instance, which has been in the news recently quite a lot, which are leading in the uprising because they have got much less to lose in opposing the regime than the big cities have. It's partly because, of course, there is more of a military presence in the big cities. If you went to Damascus, for instance, a couple of years ago, you would see military with weapons all around deployed. And they were standing there, being slightly bored, but they had their weapons and they were visible. So that's got worse, of course, because the situation is more unstable. And as I've heard from people I know in Damascus, it's more dangerous because there are explosions, and one side is blaming the other for them. But it's not safe. No matter who is responsible for the explosions and the bombs, it's just not safe for ordinary citizens.
Can you tell us a bit about the corruption, as you know it, that's happening in Syria, or is part of their psyche?
I don't think that it's part of their psyche. It's part of the way things have been developed. When the uprising started about 14 months ago, President Bashar al-Assad started a couple of reforms, where one of them was to raise the wages of people working in the public sector. And I have to admit, I did not know that the lowest wages for people who worked full-time in the public sector were as low as they were. It was something like 150 euro a month, which does not really cover anything if you live in Damascus, because you have to pay the rent and you have to pay for the food. And you have to pay your taxes, of course. Bashar al-Assad talked as well about corruption and that corruption had to be abolished. And one of the problems is actually that corruption, the way it's used in Syria, taints everybody. You have to bribe the people who give you the permission to build the house. If they want more money, they can revoke the permission and they can stop all work on your building site. So you have to start all over paying extra for getting the permission reinstated. If, for instance, you want to paint your house, you need a permission too. And this permit costs money and it costs something in bribes. You will get it, it's no problem, if you pay extra. And there are people who don't want to pay extra and they don't want the hassle, so they do things themselves. Which means that if the police controls them, and there is an awful lot of secret police around, they will say, well, what did you do? And challenged, people will say, well, we broke the law. Because they can't do anything. Either they pay the bribes, which is illegal, or they act on their own initiative, which is illegal too. So no matter what you do, you live in a country where you will always be a criminal, unless you're dead.
How do these people get the jobs? Are they friends of the president?
Yeah, they're friends of friends. You need to know the right people. Of course, becoming a member of the Ba'ath Party did a lot. And probably still does. I've heard stories, you know, I can't corroborate it. It's just something I've heard from people, individuals telling me, that you need to know people in order to get somewhere. And you need to be in the right circles. Which somehow, from my point of view, explains a bit about the way reports about the situation in Syria are coloured in Europe, for instance, in the European media. It was much worse in the beginning when I know, well, from my experience in Denmark, that people who have close relationships to leading academicians in Syria, for instance, had a much friendlier view of the regime than people who just knew ordinary people, who didn't know the people with the right connections.
It's like a two-tiered society.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. According to people I spoke to, it wasn't that bad over the last 10 years because there were certain openings in the private sector and people were allowed more personal initiative. So they were not as dependent on the goodwill of the people in power as they had been in Hafez al-Assad's time. But it's still difficult, and there still has been an awful lot of unpredictability. But that's due to the legal system as well, because, you know, you have a legal system in Syria which is recognizable for us, which is a relict from the time of the French occupation. And then with the ascendance of the Baath Party to power, you got a kind of social set of rules, which means that, yes, you may have certain rights according to the laws, but the social set of rules say that it is not in the best interest of the party and the community that you will get your right. Do you understand what I mean?
Bizarre.
Well, it is. It is, which actually means you can never ever count on what is right. It's always a matter of
luck.
And whom you know. And that's really unnerving and really difficult. And what I've heard people say time and again is they want justice and they want predictability and accountability. And that is not what they felt they got in the country they were living in.
You were saying that many children have been tortured in Syria.
Yeah, well, friends of mine lost a cousin in Homs. He was 14, he was shot. They did not know by whom. Well, someone shot a boy who was 14, and that's just a terrible thing. There are these terrible stories about not just boys, but mainly boys, who get tortured to death, and then they are just thrown somewhere by the roadside to be found by the families. But as far as I'm concerned, I know it from the news, and I know this one example from my friends. It's always very, very, very touchy where children are concerned, because it moves us so deeply. People will always come up with these stories about the babies in Kuwait in 1991, with the Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, and there were these babies who were thrown out of the hospitals and died. And, you know, it turned out not to be right. We are very touchy when it comes to children. It's a place where we can get hit. But I wouldn't be surprised. Let's put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised if a big part of what I've heard would be true.
Thank you to Anthea Page there for that feature, speaking to a Danish lady who's talking about the situation in Syria at the moment.
Malcolm Grieve reads another chapter from The Travels of Lady Hester Stanhope from the book by Virginia Childs.
Lady Hester Stanhope, Queen of the Desert, by Virginia Childs. After her visit to the Pasha, everyone was keen to meet the great English Queen. All the dignitaries vied with each other to provide the best hospitality, the most delicious sherbet, the finest ground coffee. It was not long before Lady Hester was fêted wherever she went. Women came out of their houses to strew coffee in her path, as they would for an important leader. And when she entered the bazaars, people rose as if she herself were a great pasha. Lady Hester's main reason for coming to Damascus was to see if a trip to Palmyra were possible, and if so, to organise it. Although the two cities were over 100 miles apart, it seemed to her that Damascus was a good base from which to organise the expedition. She soon decided that she could, and would, go to the desert city, and she launched into her arrangements with enthusiasm. As soon as her plans became known, everyone wanted to give her advice, but it seemed to her that very little of it was either impartial or even helpful. People were offering help and counsel for all kinds of political, religious, and financial motives, So sensibly she decided to listen to everyone, and then ignore most of what she heard. She found a good friend in the leader of the Delibachis, the cavalry based in Damascus, a simple, honest soldier with no liking for intrigue. A rich Jewish seraph or banker was another ally, and of course she had the protection of the Pasha at all times. It says much for Hester's adaptability and receptiveness that she should be able to strike up genuine friendships with such very different people. The network of contacts she was building began to spread and multiply. Everyone wanted to be the friend and advisor of the great English queen. Like Damascus, Palmyra was a town shrouded in legend and mystery. But unlike Damascus, it was derelict and only sparsely populated by a few hundred desert people who camped in shacks amid the ruins. Palmyra, also known as Tadmor, was an ancient city known to have been in existence from the beginning of the 2nd millennium BC. It was reputedly built by Solomon, but since there are records of its existence long before Solomon's time, he was probably responsible for enlarging and improving it, for it was a massive place of stunning classical beauty. As a town frequented by the Cappadocian merchants during the closing years of the 3rd dynasty of Ur, it had been a vital link in the trade routes linking Mesopotamia with Egypt. Only 3 Europeans had ever managed to visit it, and they had had to travel in disguise and secretly, because the desert that surrounded it positively bristled with ferocious Bedouin tribes. In 1750, 2 men called Wood and Dawkins had been the first to succeed in getting there, and the series of engravings that they had subsequently produced fired the imagination of generations of travellers. Many people knew of its existence, but only one other person had definitely succeeded in making the trip, and that was Burckhardt, whom Lady Hester had met. He had been discovered by the Bedou, stripped naked and thrown out of the territory. The very fact that Palmyra was so inaccessible and had never been seen by a European woman was enough to make it irresistible to Lady Hester. But there was another more personal attraction for her as well. The last ruler of Palmyra had been a woman with whom Lady Hester found it rather tempting to identify. Queen Zenobia was a powerful political leader. She was also famed for her attractiveness, her limitless energy, and her unusual mental prowess. She was, in short, a woman very like Lady Hester. And her story was dramatic. She had taken command of Palmyra and its territories when her consort, the previous ruler Odaenati, died in AD 266. Under her rule, Palmyra's power spread all over the Middle East, culminating in the occupation of Egypt in AD 270. It was not long before Aurelian, the Roman emperor, realizing that the Palmyrenes were getting too powerful, began a series of campaigns against Palmyra's garrisons. At a crucial confrontation at Amisa, Zenobia herself went to battle, but lost, and retreated to Palmyra for safety. Aurelian followed her and laid siege to the city, finally forcing Zenobia and her son to flee for their lives. They were captured on the banks of the Euphrates in AD 272 and imprisoned in Tibur, where Zenobia spent the rest of her life. Although deprived of their leader, the Palmyrenes revolted against Roman rule, but with devastating results. Aurelian returned to Palmyra, massacred the population, and destroyed the city. When Lady Hester was living in London, well before she set out on her travels, she had been greatly intrigued by a prophecy that had been made for her by a man called Richard Brothers, who was an inmate of Bedlam. He had predicted that she would go to Jerusalem, spend 7 years in the desert, and be crowned Queen of the East. It was tempting for Lady Hester to see a special significance in the quite separate and spontaneous rumours now circulating around Damascus that she was, in fact, a queen. And she was also privately intrigued by the similarities between herself and Zenobia. She was far too intelligent to take the comparison too seriously, and there were times when she laughed at herself for even thinking about it. But the genuine affinity she was beginning to feel for the Muslim people, combined with the very real power she was beginning to exert amongst them, was an intoxicating mixture. Could it be possible, she asked herself, that she was to become another queen of the desert? For now, however, it was simply romantic speculation, but one in which even Michael was caught up. He wrote of Lady Hester to General Oakes in March, just before they were finally to leave for Palmyra. Who knows but she may prove another Zenobia and be destined to restore it to its ancient splendour.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve, and also for Virginia Charles for writing the book, and I guess for the existence of Hester Stanhope, because otherwise Virginia wouldn't have written the book in the first place.
Sad news now for all those Winston Smiths out there who rejoiced last year when Channel 4 decided to axe Big Brother. Channel 5 has decided to take it on instead. Our very own Anthea Page has interviewed a man called Vladimir, who's going to be on this year's show.
I'm in Cabot Circus and I've just met someone who's got onto Big Brother. Hello.
Hello. How are you? You all right?
What's your name?
It's Vladimir.
Sounds very Russian.
Yeah, just the name, but...
Tell us what happened.
Well, not much really to say. I mean, it's been a very long audition process. It started off February this year and we've just been, you know, literally doing all the auditions. It's a very long process and we've got the confirmations on Thursday this last week and that's it really. It's all been very fast.
Why did you want to go on Big Brother?
I think it's an interesting show to be on. It's very controversial. It's now in its 13th year, and I generally think that, you know, they need someone different on the show. They need someone who can, you know, spark a bit of things in the house. And it's going to be, yeah, it's moved on to Channel 5. It's starting in June. I can't give you the exact date yet, but definitely tune in to find out.
Why do you think you fitted the criteria?
Big Brother always selects different people, so you need to have your homosexuals, you need to have, you know, different colours. I wanted to go into the house to have something new, show something else, really, be genuine. I think there's been a lot of people who put on a show kind of house. So it's going in there as natural as I can be and see if the public like me.
What are you hoping to get out of it? Will it help your career in any way?
Potentially, maybe. I mean, I've worked in radio and TV before, actually radio presenter as well. So I think it could just help a bit with the scores. It's a very short game that you live with. It will be 6 months to a year, and then we'll see where it takes us from there.
Are you a bit worried about the reaction that you might have to other people?
Yeah, I think the public will always make their own mind up. You know, I'll either go into the house and they'll hate me from the beginning or they'll love me. It's going to be a love-hate relationship. I think what the people think, everyone's entitled to their own opinion as long as if they want to voice it, they can voice it.
I meant with the other people in the house. Do you think it might get a bit bitchy in there?
I think there's going to be a lot of bitchiness. There's going to be, I mean, we've literally got cameras 24 hours a day on us, microphones as well. You go in there knowing that you've got to expect the worst, really, and just hope for the best.
Do you think the cameras intrude a bit too much sometimes? I think it invades people's privacy, the bedrooms and things.
I think cameras are there to pick up on the best moments. I mean, the way the show's done, they have 24 hours of footage to edit it down in 1 hour. Cameras are everywhere, even in the toilets, but they don't show that footage. It's just for our security and safety, really. But I think one's going to have to just get used to the cameras. It's going to be, you know, it's a daunting thing at first, but you go in there expecting that, really.
What kind of cultural value do you think this show has on the population?
Not much. I think it's more entertainment. You know, people go in there or they watch it because it's fun, it's entertaining. It's going to be a great year for England this year. We've got the Olympics, we've got the Diamond Jubilee. So I think it's going to take that whole, you know, something new to the year as well.
Do you think it sets a bad moral example to the population?
I don't think so. No, I think the show's very informative and, you know, it brings out the best of people. Again, it's, you know, people, if they want to judge it badly, they can judge it badly, but...
Tell us your full name so we can look out for you.
I can't tell you my full name at the moment. You'll have to look out, find out in June on Channel 5, Big Brother.
Yeah. Well, he's very good looking. I'll describe him. He's got dark brown hair and lovely dark brown eyes, and he does look quite Russian. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page and to Vladimir.
I'd like to welcome Tony D'Arpino, a one-time resident of San Francisco for many years, and now he's here in Bristol, and is here to read some poetry.
Good evening. Tonight I'd like to read Perro's Bridge. I think everyone in Bristol may know Perro's Bridge. It's named after a servant of the Pinneys, an old sugar family, and it's a famous walking bridge over the floating harbor. Perro's Bridge. I don't need a bridge. A horn of rum, yes. I had a bridge once, a tree across a stream. My own secret bridge in the woods, the jungle of home, where I was the secret, till they told me the real secret. Slave boy, not just boy. I was already drunk when the poets showed up, a dope and a doper. They seemed okay. I spit in their wine anyway. I was dreaming of my island and the shade of the baobab tree at Pinner's house, Montravers, before we came to Racedown and Great George Street. We traveled like Cork, my sisters and I, and like Cork I went back, a floating island, bumping black coral and gravestones of sugar. I don't need a bridge. A horn of rum, yes. I had a bridge once. A tree across a stream. The Mute Swans at Welshback. The Pisan tilt of the Landotter trough shadows the Bure and lends medieval lines to the old neighborhood. Nearby, the needle of St. Mary Redcliffe, more tapered than Cleopatra's, but from the same warren, stands noonish in a mesh of rivers and birds and circling hares. Tap, 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 blind pew. The black spot grows like the lichen on the tables of Shakespeare's Brown October. The leaning church of the Templars, circular temple, invisible circles now. Rusting bollards from every era line the loud docks. Swans, mute swans, here and in the new cut, beyond the gate of the ruined prison, where the tidal wash becalms the low-tide mute button. Mute swans, mute only on the water. When they fly, they bleat a little with each wing beat. Mute swans sing.
Thank you very much, Tony D'Arpino. Do you have a book published? Or?
I'm glad you asked. Last year, my first book to be published in England was published by Redcliffe Press, Floating Harbour. Still available in bookstores everywhere, especially in Bristol.
Okay. For those of you who are interested in looking up like, online, for example, how do you spell D'Arpino?
That's D apostrophe, capital A-R, P-I-N-O, and you can roll the R if you really want to, but that only works on radio.
D'Arpino, thank you very much for coming in.
Cool, thank you.
It's time to introduce Jeff, repeat in his Motorhead t-shirt, which says Sacrifice.
Thank you, hello, this is What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday 25th of May, Katie Brooks will be performing with support from Blind Atlas at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Into Saturday 26th of May, 60s legends The Pretty Things, who still have founding members Phil May and Dick Taylor, will be performing with support from Mile Chicks at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £13 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present Kate Le Bon. She's a Welsh singer-songwriter musician from Cardiff in Wales, and in her career she has performed with Gruff Rhys of Super Furry Animals fame, as well as performing at festivals such as Glastonbury and Latitude. This is from our second studio album, CYRK, and it's the track Falcon Eyed. Kate Le Bon with Falcon Eyed from the album CYRK. For more information, you can check out www.katelebon.com. That is CATELEBON, katelebon.co.uk. Keeping with 26th of May, U2 will be performing at the Victoria in Victoria Road, Swindon. Tickets are £6 in advance and doors open at 8 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 27th of May, the prog rock group Focus will be performing with support from Serious Blues at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £16.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to Jess Barks. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest this week, who's Caroline Bowler, and also to, well, Tony Gosling, who's a studio guest technically. Features were by Anthea Page and the aforementioned Tony Gosling. Malcolm Grieve read an excerpt from Lady Hester's Travels from the book by Virginia Childs. And we had some poetry by Tony D'Arpino.
And we also had Jeff Sparks, who's back in the studio with his What's On Guide. The studio engineer this week was Mike Noyce, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from me until next week, Michaela Dennis, and it's goodbye from John.
Thank you.
Now there's where my heart is turning ever, there's where the old folks stay. Now all up and down the whole creation, sadly I roam, yet I'm still dreaming of the old plantation and of the old.